Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. Find out more at canbyfoursquare.com or on Sunday mornings at 9 and 11 a.m.
This episode is also brought to you by Chris Salee, your local health markets insurance agency. Creative solutions for your health, Medicare, and life insurance needs. Personalized advice at 503-678-5768. Welcome to the Canby Now podcast,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Three members of the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners gave a preliminary nod to a tweaked version of the strategic investment program that will save Columbia Distributing's new Canby facility an estimated $5.1 million in property taxes over the next 15 years. Chair Jim Bernard, along with Commissioners Martha Schrader and Ken Humberston, reviewed the agreement at a policy session Tuesday afternoon and, after hearing from Canby Fire Chief Jim Davis, gave it their unanimous approval to be moved to a future business meeting for final consideration. The Canby City Council must also sign off on the document, and if both bodies agree, it will head to the Oregon Business Development Commission, which has the final say. The commission expects to see Columbia's Strategic Investment Zone application on April 10th. If it's approved, one of the most impacted districts will be Canby Fire, which is projected to lose out on an estimated $800,000 in revenue over the 15-year period. The biggest losers, according to the county's numbers, would be Canby Schools at $2.21 million. Assuming the current bond rates are continued, the city itself at $1.41 million, the Canby Urban Renewal Agency at $903,656, and finally the county itself at $836,699. Chief Davis told commissioners that his district is not necessarily against the program, it's just they didn't know about it. Their financial outlook for the future had been based on Columbia being taxed at the full rate.
It's not that we're opposed to the 2010 law. It's just that, number one, we didn't know about it. We didn't know about the law. We didn't know of this option. The fire district had performed some financial planning, anticipating the $68 million assessed valuation moving forward. And we're very, very surprised when this was put in front of the city council for consideration.
Approved in 2010, the county's Rural Strategic Investment Zone program gives qualifying projects a 15-year abatement on property taxes due over the $25 million mark. Businesses must pay full taxes on the first $25 million and follow other criteria such as hiring locally and using local contractors where possible. The company must also give back a quarter of the abated taxes in the form of a community service fee, the disbursement of which must be agreed upon by all the impacted taxing districts. In this case, Columbia's full abated amount is anticipated to be $6.89 million, but it will return $1.72 million of that in the community service fee for a total savings of around $5 million. According to the company's CFO, their chief financial officer, this incentive was an important factor in the decision by the nation's fourth largest beverage distributor to relocate their Portland metro area operations to Canby. However, due to an apparent miscommunication between Columbia and Business Oregon, the company failed to file its application before beginning construction, which is a prerequisite to being considered. Initially, it appeared that they would disqualify Columbia from participating in the program. But staff working with the county and the state soon hammered out a compromise that would render ineligible only the work that took place prior to when the state received the company's application on July 2nd. Any work that took place after that date, which was the vast majority of the actual construction, would still be eligible for the abatement under the Strategic Investment Program. Speaking this week, Chief Davis didn't necessarily seem to be clear on how this, quote, compromise fits into the existing law governing the program.
The big issue here is process. The law is very clear that the application has to be submitted and approved prior to building construction. And the building was well on its way before the submission, unless we can, and that's our point, is we can't get anybody to give us a firm answer on that question as far as when was it submitted for and approved prior to construction, because Columbia Distribution walls have been up for quite some time, and we've spent a great deal amount of time out at Columbia on code enforcement issues.
Davis also wondered whether such a program should even still exist. It was created during the depths of the economic downturn, when economic growth was the exception, not the rule, and major incentives were necessary to attract any type of significant investment. As the recent boom in development at the Canby Pioneer Industrial Park suggests, that may no longer be the case. For his part, Chief Davis believes the companies who have moved to Canby would have done so with or without the strategic investment zone.
Keep in mind, too, when this law was developed in 2010, step back as far as where we were then, and there was no growth going on in Canby at the time or in the county, and so everybody was doing what they could to try to promote growth. And that's not the way it is in Canby right now in the industrial area. It's growing substantially. And I feel that these businesses would move into Canby with or without this at this point, because they're receiving substantial savings already in electrical rates, as well as perhaps moving from Multnomah County into Clackamas County or into Canby. They're already receiving a reduction, and that's quite a bit different than it was in 2010.
While the losses to Canby schools, the fire district, city, and the other taxing entities are substantial, it's important to view these numbers in light of what they're gaining. Revenue on the company's taxable portion of its property amounts to more than $6.9 million over the next 15 years, according to the county. Add to that the estimated community service fee totaling $1.72 million, and you get a grand total of $8,629,234, which is, you know, nothing to sneeze at. In fact, it's easily one of the largest tax bills the city of Canby will see over the next decade and a half. The council's work session to discuss Columbia's Strategic Investment Zone application has been scheduled for 6 p.m. March 4th in the Willow Creek Conference Room of the Canby Civic Building. And so it begins. Again. In protest of the state's latest proposed cap and trade bill, the Republican members of the Senate walked out on Monday to deny the quorum Democratic senators needed to hold a vote on it and other measures. The cap and trade bill, a revised version of last year's climate proposal, which died in the aftermath of another Republican walkout, would change the way the state regulates greenhouse gas emissions and require carbon-producing businesses to purchase pollution credits. It may sound simple, but it is not. Republican lawmakers, as well as groups representing rural Oregonians and working families such as Timber Unity, have been sharply critical of the proposal, saying it will devastate the state's economy while failing to make any discernible impact on the environment. On Tuesday, House Republican leader and Canby's state representative, Christine Drazen, joined her GOP counterparts in leading her own caucus from the state capitol over their opposition to what she calls, quote, this bad bill and the allegedly partisan process that created it. Quote, they are treating this session like it is the launch of their campaigns rather than an opportunity to approve budgets, adopt technical fixes, and pass consensus legislation, Drazen said of the Democrats. We have 35 short days to do the people's work, and instead of working together on the many issues that have strong bipartisan support, they are determined to marginalize and ignore working Oregonians. The first-term lawmaker's growing frustration with the process become increasingly obvious, something she also discussed during an appearance on the Can Be Now podcast last year, following a longer session working with the same supermajority. This week she said, quote, "I continue to engage, voice my concerns, and fight for a fair process. But Democrats have made it clear they don't want our input on climate. They want our presence to facilitate their agenda. They don't want the value of our voices. They want to make deals with special interests and push this legislation through regardless of constitutional concerns, despite the fact it is dogged by bipartisan opposition." On Saturday, Representative Drazen had moved an amendment to the House's version of the cap-and-trade bill that would have referred the measure to a vote. It was voted down along party lines. While Republican senators' walkout on Monday leaves the future of pending bills and other matters in jeopardy, Drazen and others place the blame on the Democrats, whom they feel left them no other choice. "I am tired of hearing we won't know the impact till it's passed," she said. "The abuse of power is rampant. Oregonians deserve to have the final word on this dirty deal." The Canby City Council met in a special session on Tuesday night and unanimously appointed current Assistant City Administrator and HR Director Amanda Zyber to the role of Interim City Administrator. The Council also approved her receiving a 10% pay increase during the time she will serve in this role. Speaking to the Canby Now podcast late Tuesday night, Mayor Brian Hodson explained, quote, "We feel that Ms. Zyber, who has done very well in the interim role in the past, will keep our projects moving forward and lead staff through the budget committee." Zyber, who has been with the city since 2007, served 8 months as interim city administrator in 2009 following the departure of Mark Adcock, and again 5 years later when Greg Ellis left to accept a job with the state. Ellis had reportedly recommended Zyber as his successor, but things went a different direction. The council ultimately settled on Rick Robinson, whom they actually recruited out of retirement after a more than 20-year career in executive government in Northern and Central California. Replacing Robinson was Scott McClure, an experienced administrator who had most recently served more than 12 years as city manager of Monmouth. But McClure lasted only 4 months before the council moved to dismiss him last week without giving a reason. Per the terms of his contract, McClure received severance pay worth 6 months of his salary, which is $150,000 annually, and 6 months of health insurance. The city used a highly regarded executive search firm, Peckham and McKinney, to lead the recruitment process, and that ultimately landed them McClure. Because his tenure lasted only a few months, the firm agreed to conduct a new recruitment for the city at no additional charge besides direct expenses. Mayor Hodson said the council will be meeting with Peckham and McKinney in the coming weeks to confirm the job description and candidate profile. They hope to find, quote, the right candidate and have them in the position within the next 4 to 5 months. Both lanes of the Hubbard Cutoff Road, that's Highway 551, were closed for several hours Monday as Oregon State Police investigated a serious injury crash that occurred there near the Aurora State Airport. Aurora Fire District, with assistance from Canby Fire District and Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, responded to a report of a two-vehicle crash involving an SUV and a dump truck. Firefighters arrived to find that there were two people injured, the driver of the SUV trapped in their vehicle. The driver of the dump truck was able to get out of the vehicle on their own. A Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue ambulance treated and transported the driver of the dump truck to an area trauma hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. It took firefighters 32 minutes to cut and remove parts of the vehicle to free the trapped SUV driver. The driver was treated by Woodburn ambulance personnel and transported by Life Flight to a Portland area trauma hospital with critical injuries. Oregon State Police is continuing to investigate the cause of the crash. Hey, we know what you're thinking. Dang, Camby, you're looking good for 150. Well, you know, we get that a lot. But the city of Camby does indeed celebrate its sesquicentennial. Are you smarter than me? Do you know how to pronounce that word? I'm not sure, but we'll go with sesquicentennial this year, meaning it's the 150th anniversary of the town being named and platted. That's fancy talk for laid out with streets and blocks and such. Carol Palmer, former chair of the Heritage and Landmark Commission and project lead for the Sesquicentennial Program, and other organizers have spent a lot of time researching the city's centennial celebrations in 1970, which were quite substantial. Says HLC Chair Jennifer Geiler, thanks to records stored at the Depot Museum and the city's archive, we know city leaders conducted a six-month-long program which included several special events while integrating the centennial theme into existing events. This time around, the city will be using, quote, the same approach, according to Economic Development Director Jamie Stickle. Quote, we will hold a few special events, but primarily rely on Camby's full slate of summer programs to provide a platform for commemorating our 150th, she said. The city, working with the HLC, is kicking off Camby's sesquicentennial at 6:30 p.m. March 4th in the lobby of the Civic Center. Birthday cake, refreshments, commemorative buttons, and more will be available. The program will also include recognition of an honored guest, Janine Kersey, great-great-granddaughter of Philander Lee. 1870 was a banner year for Camby, and Lee played a key role in those events. The Oregon and California Railroad Company, the O&C, purchased land from the Knight family and Lee to construct a rail line and establish a town. The proposed town site was surveyed and named for General E.R.S. Canby, a Civil War hero who led the decisive Union victory and the Battle of Glorieta Pass, known to some as the Gettysburg of the West. Lee filed the townsite plat with the county on August 9th of that year. Shortly thereafter, William and George Knight began construction of Knight Brothers Mercantile on what is now the site of Mattress World, establishing what is most likely Camby's first commercial structure. When Camby was officially incorporated in 1893, the first city council met in a cramped storage room above the main store. Questions on the 150th anniversary celebration program can be directed to Palmer at carolpalmer24@gmail.com.
Police beat for the week of January 7th through January 13th. At 3:09 p.m., report of a suspect entering a common laundry room at an apartment complex and taking coins from the machines. And a person matching the same description was also seen in a tenant's yard. What was he doing? He was exposing himself. Oh my goodness. January 8th at 2:08 p.m. following a traffic stop, the driver was arrested for an outstanding warrant and cited for driving while suspended and driving uninsured. His vehicle was also impounded, which is the proper thing to do. So many people's lives are at stake. At 11:08, following a traffic stop, a man traveling to Camby to meet a female he met online was arrested on two outstanding warrants and for possession of methamphetamine. That's good. So glad people are bringing that into our city. On January 9th at 12:08 p.m., report of possible embezzlement. At 4:45 p.m., report of a fraudulent seller providing unpaid or stolen merchandise to an unsuspecting victim. Most victims are unsuspecting, though. I mean, I think that's kind of redundant, because if they're suspecting to be victims, then they're just paranoid. At 9:06 p.m., report of an unwanted person trespassing on private property. Officers advised the man that he was officially trespassed from the location and would be arrested if he returned. 9:35 p.m., a biological parent who had traveled without permission to Canby with their child was located and arrested for violation of a protective order and DUI. I mean, that just kind of goes to never mind. Don't need to touch that one. At January 10th at 8:05 a.m., report of three individuals attempting to break into a storage trailer without success. Officers located and questioned the individuals and seized methamphetamine, counterfeit currency, and drug paraphernalia. Just the cream of the crop going there. At 1:02 p.m., report of hit and run and damage to a parked vehicle. Because we all know in Canby, parked vehicles are the ones that get hurt the most. 6:53 p.m., when a person who had previously been trespassed from a store returned to the same location, they were stopped, warned, and cited for a felon in possession of a restricted weapon. The weapon was also seized. At 6:45 p.m., following a stop of an uninsured vehicle, the driver was arrested on an outstanding warrant, and also, I don't know if you can guess what he possibly was in possession of, but it was meth. He was in possession of meth. A January 11th at 1:21 p.m. report of a fraud after a victim mailed cash to a scammer who claimed a family member was in trouble. 5:57 p.m. an uninsured vehicle was stopped. The driver, whose license was suspended, was arrested for possession of a kitty cat. I'm joking, it's meth. It's always meth. On January 12th, a juvenile who had previously been reported as a runaway was located. On January 13th, at 4:10 a.m., a speeding vehicle was stopped and the driver was arrested for DUI, alcohol, and cited for speeding and driving uninsured. And finally, at 8:14 p.m., a suspended driver was cited and his uninsured vehicle was towed.
Hey, Tyler, I have to tell you about something.
All right.
This buddy of mine was telling me his internet bill went up right after the holidays. Can you believe it?
I'm sorry, what?
I know. Talk about a Grinch move, am I right?
Why would their bill go up at that time of year, Frankie?
Well, they said it was because of overage fees from going over their data cap. Probably because they had family home for the holidays with way more people than usual using their Wi-Fi. Think about it. You've got kids playing games online, parents streaming TV shows and movies, plus all of the devices everyone has that are connected to the Wi-Fi network. That's a lot of stuff using up data, and they were charged extra for it.
That's super weird. I didn't even know there were like actual things called data caps for internet providers. I use a ton of data every month right here in the studio. And I've never seen an extra fee.
Yeah, that's because we have DirectLink. With them, not only will we never be charged extra fees for using lots of data at any speed, but they also never slow down our internet speed for high usage. It's all part of their commitment to unlimited internet.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Well, hey, it sounds like your friend should switch over to DirectLink.
Yeah, no kidding.
Hey, friends, it's James again. Favorite time of the show because we get to talk about the best people in the world, which, of course, you know by now are the Canby Now podcast Patreon subscribers. We call them our Canby Now Plus members. And this week, we are giving a special Canby Now shout out. Our undying gratitude goes to Tony Helbling. Tony, if you're listening, thank you so much because we rely on monthly contributions from wonderful, fantastic, amazing people like Tony to continue to do this work that we love. So if you want to be shouted out on the Canby Now podcast and to find out how you can become one of obviously the coolest people in the world, you can visit canbynowpod.com/plus. Once again, Tony, thank you so much. We are grateful.
Joining us on the line now is local resident Kara Hawkins. She's part of a new group that's just getting itself organized called Friends of Canby Parks. Hi, Kara.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for being on. So you were just starting to tell us a little bit about the process and kind of where you're at with that. I asked you if you're the president and you were like, well, that doesn't really exist right now.
Well, so I've been going to Echo Park. We live close enough that I can walk there. And so I've been going there for 20 plus years and enjoying it. But my dog got really sick about a year and a half ago. And so instead of doing a lot of different walks, we pretty much have been confined to that walk. And over the past year and a half, I have just grown to appreciate and love that place so much. And I just have a sense of gratitude every time I'm there. I know that ivy is really bad for trees, and I started noticing how many trees were actually falling. And it just kind of all clicked together that something needed to be done. And so I started carrying clippers with me every time I would go. I walk there 5 days a week, and I would do my goal was to do five trees every time I walked. So I did that for a couple of weeks, and before I realized that this was just a monster task and there was no way that I was going to do it myself.
Right.
So, and then I also found a tree that had an ivy vine on it that was as big around as my arm. And so I had my husband come with me, and he brought a little saw, and because there's no way that I was going to be able to get that off the tree.
Yeah.
And so then we started doing weekends where we would go once a weekend and spend, you know, whatever amount of time and do a bunch of trees. And we just kind of did it scattered throughout the park. And then even, you know, as we were talking, we were realizing there was just no way we were going to be able to do this. And so I know a guy who is on the Canby Parks board, and so I talked to him about creating this Facebook group. And he said, well, why don't you come to our meeting and present your idea, and we'll talk about it and figure it out. And so I did that, and they all were super enthusiastic. They said, we know it needs to be done. We simply don't have the resources, and so go for it.
What is it, just to interject here, we're talking about basically a volunteer group that helps with the maintenance of parks? Is that basically it? Or are you just ivy specialist?
No, well, so that's a really good question. So initially I was going to say Friends of Echo Park, because that's my passion.
Right.
But then I thought, you know, there may be projects down the road that I'm unaware of that we could help with. And so if we got a group that was, you know, a solid group, I'm envisioning things that, and I've offered that to the city, that if there are times where, I don't know, planting flowers, picking up garbage, I'm not sure what the project would be, but our group, I certainly would be open to it, and I would think that anybody that's passionate about parks in general would be open to it as well. So that's why I named it more broadly rather than just focused on Echo Park.
Cool.
Yeah. So anyway, once I got it, then it was a couple of weeks before I actually had approval to move forward. And then I got the approval, and then I was so excited about it that I put it out on Facebook and Nextdoor and to get a group, and it only had a week's notice, and so we did have a total of six people show up, which I thought was pretty great. Two people that I didn't know at all, and the others were, you know, my husband and some friends, and so
it still counts,
and we were able to clear over just over 100 trees that day.
Wow!
And in 1 hour, and my goal is the 1 hour, because I don't want to wear people out. And an hour, I mean, it's a little strenuous, but, you know, at the last one, my 5-year-old and 9-year-old granddaughter showed up and helped. So, you know, it's doable. So I was encouraged about that, set another date, and then really worked on getting the word out as much as possible. It's hard, you know, with Facebook, the way it works is unless people like it and share it, it's limited in its scope until enough people are in the group. So I kind of floundered around initially, but I've started getting more interest. And the last time we were there, we had 24 people show up.
Wow.
And it gives me goosebumps. I just can't even express to you how how wonderful I feel like that is. And it makes me love the city and love the people. And just, it just, yeah, it was wonderful. More than I would have dreamt.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah. So today I posted a picture of the map of Echo Park just to kind of help people understand the scope of this problem. And we, if I get at least 10 volunteers this coming Sunday from 10:30 to 11:30, I anticipate being able to finish the first section that we started working on, which is the section that's closest to Territorial Road. But my long range vision is that we get the trees cleared, which is, you know, triaging is the most important thing so that we don't lose more trees. We've lost at least three large trees over the winter. And then ultimately I want to clear the ivy completely from the park. So take it out of the floor. So when we go, we focus on pulling the ivy up from around the base of the tree to destroy the root system of the ivy and then just pull it off the tree just, you know, a few feet up so it doesn't harm the bark of the tree. So there's a little bit of a technique to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually one of those jobs where once you get started, you just want to keep going. At least I do. You know, like a jigsaw puzzle or unwinding yarn, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it was a great group we had last time, and I am hoping, I'm trying to put the word out to various community groups in the city and have actually had some response that they're going to at least let their membership know about it so that it'll just broadcast the word a little bit better. So
that sounds awesome. I'm just looking at the photo that you posted of the map, which is actually the map from the park that's on the big board there, and you circled that first section. It looks like it's maybe like a fifth or a sixth of the total park. I mean, like you said, it is a significant problem. So even with the work you guys have done to this point, which is quite impressive, it's a big job.
Yeah, really big job. And, you know, the other thing is we're kind of working against the clock. So there is poison oak in there, but it's dormant at this time of year. So there's, you know, almost no risk of going in there. That's what Jeff from the city parks has told me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but as the weather warms, it will get foliage. And then that's when we are at risk for getting it.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously we don't want to put, especially little kids, you know, at risk for anything like that.
Sure.
So it's something we're going to monitor closely, but it also shortens our window for, we've got to get as much done as we can as soon as possible before that happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and then, so I, as much as I would like to keep going, you know, obviously we have to use our noodles here and then we'll just pick it up again in the fall. And
sure.
So I see this as a long-term project.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and the other thing as well, you know, this time of year, you've got the Bigfoots hibernating, but, after, you know, come spring, summer, they'll be out roaming around. You don't want to have a run-in with one of them either, so.
No, yeah, we don't. Yeah. Although, if I could teach them how to pull ivy, you know, that might be helpful.
You know, that might be a good outreach to those folks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Big burly guys like that.
Good point. I love it. You've got definitely the heart and creativity of a very effective organizer.
Thank
Kara,
you.
So, I wonder if you have heard or if you would respond to maybe some folks that are hearing about this and like, we pay this maintenance fee, we pay taxes to parks, why can't the city just do this or whatever? I imagine, you know, like you've already kind of mentioned, first of all, there's just too much work with all the parks to go around, even with the paid workers that we have, but also the sense of joy that you've found in being able to give something back to a place that you love and to make it even more enjoyable and to have sort of that sense of community ownership. The city of Canby was built this way.
Yep, absolutely. I 1,000% agree. Yeah. I have had a couple people raise that comment,
mm-hmm.
and my response is, well, one of my personal philosophies is give more than you take. Mm-hmm. And this is an opportunity to build community. It's 1 hour, maybe every 2 weeks, if you can manage that. And it feels so good, and it's doing such a great thing. I mean, there's just no losers here. There's just no, there's no downside to any of this. So I think it's an opportunity. And like the city said, they simply don't have the resources to do it. So the choice is we do it, it doesn't get done, or they raise our taxes in order to do it.
Right.
You know, I think this is the best option.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. And I think most folks, when they really think about it, would agree with that as well.
Yeah, I do too.
So, yeah, do you have kind of the next several ones scheduled, or you just do them one at a time?
I do them one at a time.
Okay.
And kind of try to talk to people. I did this at the last time, is kind of talk to people about what kind of looks for, you know, if they're planning on, and I try attending again. I've also tried to kind of scatter them around a little bit, although this one is exactly the same time and day of the week that we did the last one. And I just kind of thought, while we're building, it might be good to have a time when, you know, we already know we had a good turnout. So let's do that again, see what kind of a turnout we get. But I'm totally open to moving it around. I assume Saturdays and Sundays are best for people.
Yeah.
A lot of the folks that we had, I mean, it's so impressive last time. A lot of the folks that we had were like retirement age. And so for them, and I work 2 days a week, so and for me, there's other days I could do it. But I want to, you know, make it available for as many people as possible while still at the same time not overdoing it so that people get burned out on it.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. So the very next one is going to be this Saturday. Give us
Sunday.
The details. Oh, this Sunday. Okay.
Sunday from 10:30 to 11.
Okay, great. And
yeah,
you just meet at like the parking lot of Echo there by the logging trail or?
Yep.
Okay.
And, the city has asked that we have people sign a sheet that just keeps track of their hours, and so it's everybody just has to sign in. And then I've kind of revamped the sheet a little bit to add so that people are keeping track of how many trees they do, so that
can
have a somewhat, you know, accurate count. Because I think that that is, to me, that's really inspiring and rewarding. To see that number go up and up.
Yeah, absolutely. So cool. Well, Kara, I think this is an awesome idea. I commend you and the other folks that are helping you and help organize this. So that's going to be this Sunday. Hopefully the weather will be nice, a nice chance to meet some, maybe meet some new folks in the community and get outside, get a little exercise and help one of our local treasures and local assets, Echo Park, continue to prosper and be beautiful for generations to come.
Yep.
Do you have contact information if folks have questions or want to just connect with you in some way, or do you just direct people to this Friends of Canby Parks Facebook group? Okay.
And they can message me through that. So,
okay. Cool. That sounds great. Well, thank you again, Kara. Good luck.
All right. Thank you so much.
I'm here at Advantage Mortgage with Derek Hill. And Derek, you were telling me about something that just came down from Fannie Mae that people might be interested in.
Yeah, Fannie Mae just came out with a report that said that the average homeowner in the United States has approximately 70% equity in their home.
Oh,
now,
wow.
Right. I mean, that's obviously average throughout the whole country. But because values have come up so substantially in the last 10 years, there is a ton of equity available that people can utilize.
Cool. So if people are potentially like looking to buy or move into a new home, you're saying that equity means it might be something that you would look at remodeling instead of if the market's not looking favorable to you.
Right, 100%. Because the market in Portland is so tough to buy, you know, we have an average of like 2.5 months worth of inventory. So it's just super hard for people to find what they're looking for. It may be just easier for them to take out some equity and do the upgrades or do an addition or pay off some debt, or lots of different things. And that's one of the things that we love to do with people is sit down with them and kind of go over a game plan. You know, cool. Just that's one of the biggest things is knowing what you can do. And we love taking the time to do that for people.
Awesome. Awesome. And people can find you on your website or just give you a call.
Yeah, they can go to findtheadvantage.com or call 266-5800, obviously 503 area code. And we love to chit chat, and we have, you know, 8 or 9 different loan officers here in the Canby office that would love to sit down with somebody and work with them.
Cool. Thanks, Derek.
So just remember, Derek Hill, NMLS number 50183, Advantage Mortgage, NMLS number 177059, equal housing opportunity.
All right, joining us on the line now is another candidate for Clackamas County Sheriff and also another current employee of the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. We have Sergeant Lynn Schoenfeld. Hi, Sergeant Schoenfeld.
Hello.
How are you?
Doing good, doing good.
Good. Well, tell us a little bit about your background and experience. You've been with the, I know you've been in law enforcement for some time. Is it, has it always been with the CCSO?
No, about in 92, about 28 years ago,
okay.
I was working as an electronics engineer in Lake Grove.
Oh, wow.
For microsystems out there.
Interesting time to be in electronics back then, I would imagine. Yeah.
A lot of neat changes and whatnot. My undergrad, I received from Oregon Tech down there in Klamath Falls.
Cool.
Anyway, have a brother, Frank Schoenfeld, who's the chief of Molalla Police Department now. And at the time, he was Oregon City officer. And then my now current brother-in-law was an officer there. And they got me involved with the reserve program.
Mm-hmm.
And coming right off of a volunteer firefighter volunteerism situation in Klamath Falls, where I lived in the firehouse, it seemed like the right thing to do. And then I got into the reserve program, and I found myself putting out 130 hours a month of volunteer time. It was like steeper than my existing job. So that's kind of how I got into it. And then within 8 months, I realized that even with the analytical objective background, that law enforcement was really a calling for me. So within eight months, I started putting out applications, and I was hired at the Sherwood Police Department. Now, mind you, that was when Sherwood had 3 police officers. So it was a growing town, not near what it is now,
but right.
it was kind of a really neat situation for me to get involved with the community and kind of cut my teeth in the law enforcement industry. So heck, that was 28 years ago.
Yeah.
So I was there for a year and a half. And of course, like everything, for years it seems like we've always been in budget crunches, and we were told that it might be a tough year, and if you guys have a chance to apply other places, it might be a wise idea. So I started firing my application around with the idea that I always wanted to come to Clackamas County because it's where my brother and my brother-in-law were and all my friends. And so a year and a half after working at Sherwood Police Department, I was able to get hired on at Clackamas County in April of 1994.
Okay.
So since April of 1994, I've went back to school because I'd started on MSEE at Portland State when I was working as an electronics engineer. And so I always wanted to get back and get that master's degree, but with the career change, I'm like, an MSEE wouldn't be the way to go if I was going to make a career of law enforcement. So many years ago, I went and changed my major over to a MBA with a specialty in the what they call the MIT option, which is management of innovation and technology.
Oh, cool.
So I spent a few years working on my MBA at Portland State and attained that while I was working my way through the ranks at the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. I took off on a run because it was a neat time to join Clackamas because there was a lot of changes happening.
Sure.
And like right off the bat, got right into working that, you know, back in the mid-90s when we had a gang unit. We called it the CART team. Hmm. And was assigned to that right off the bat and met a lot of great people and really
what,
got into
it. What was that unit called?
It was called CART. It stood for the Community Action Response Team.
Okay.
And that was the that was our gang enforcement unit.
Yeah.
The mid-90s was, we had quite a gang issue in the central Clackamas area, so that was how we addressed it, with a small interagency team. And
I was hoping that it was called that because you drove around on go-karts, but it sounds like it wasn't it wasn't that much fun.
Oh, it was interesting back then. So after while I was on the CART team, I've been in the department for a few years. That's when I was in became interested in the tactical unit, so the special weapons and tactics team.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
quickly, you know, applied, and that was a good part of my life. SWAT for 14-15 years. Met a lot of great people, had a lot of great training, got to interact with a lot of great interagency people. So during my years on SWAT, I ranged everything from a basic SWAT operator to a team leader. Once I became sergeant, I remained on the team and became a team leader. And then there was a time where we were in between commanders, which is usually a lieutenant on the SWAT team. So I was made the commander of the team, interim commander for a year. So I commanded the team in the last portion of my SWAT career. Also, while the time I was on SWAT, became involved in the supervisor realm of things. Obviously, got promoted to sergeant, and I've been a sergeant for about 20 years at the agency. So I've supervised everything from the special weapons and tactics team to the special investigations unit, detective investigations, computer forensics, our what we call now CRAFT, or our crash our reconstruction team.
Right.
Having the engineering background, it was kind of a particular love of mine, being able to use my kinematic equations and whatnot to and apply it to police work, which is interesting, the logical aspect of a good investigation.
I'm just picturing you, Sergeant, at the scene of a crash with like the numbers floating around your head, like that GIF of Zach Galifianakis. But that's probably not quite how it works.
I was one of my nicknames back on the SWAT team was the Professor. So oh, there.
Kind of there you go.
It rings so true. So yeah, another thing. And then after I left Special Investigations, continued with SWAT, I became involved with the Transit Police Division as a supervisor of the freshly opened Green Line. And so it had been open for about 10 months before I took over as the what we call the South Precinct, which is right there at the Clackamas Town Center Mall. And to be a supervisor of a transit unit, it's a division under the Portland Police Bureau. However, it's the largest interagency task force on the West Coast. Hmm. At that time, we had about 70 officers from 17 different agencies around the regional area.
Wow.
Addressing issues with the transit system, community meetings, of course, direct supervision. Mm-hmm. Of 17 different agencies, which is difficult for a supervisor because you have to know 17 different policies and procedure manuals for the people who you're supervising. So
right.
I had a lot of good exposure to, to the TriMet board, saying my piece. You notice I'm somewhat of a pragmatic, objective person. Mm. Based on my upbringing and, of course, my objective background in the education field that I that I've chosen, and so we've transitioned into back into patrol after about 6 years. They had me hang on an extra 2 years in transit, because it's usually a 4 year stint, but I hung on an extra 2 years because we knew the Orange Line was going to open. And there would be a lot of meetings that I need to go to and whatnot, so we can make sure that when the Orange Line did open, that people were aware of, you know, the impact it would have on our livability.
Mm-hmm.
And so that became a passion of mine at that point. I've been happy being a sergeant, and I've been happy being a mentor we have some great deputies, and that's where my passion lies. I never aspired to climb the ladder because I was most effective where I was. And I've been I'm the senior sergeant. I'll be retiring on Thursday, but I've been the senior sergeant for quite a while, and I've enjoyed kicking the barriers out of the way. I've enjoyed watching people I've trained promote, make special units. There's lots of people in management that have been on my special units. I've supervised directly, or people that sat in my seat as an FTO, because right off the bat, you know, when I joined the sheriff's office, I've been training deputies and sergeants since my first year here.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you mention that you're retiring soon?
Yes, I'll be retiring on Thursday.
Oh, okay. Congratulations. Yeah. When folks are listening to this, actually.
Yes, that'll be my retirement day, and I'm looking forward to it because it's tough to run for sheriff while you're still employed, and I'm looking forward to getting out there. We've already hit the ground running. We are at a sprint and having fun with it.
I believe you announced on Valentine's Day or right around there.
Yes.
Was there any particular significance to that, or just
there wasn't a significance? The timing was right, and I'm gonna tell you, I have obviously growing up and coming up through the ranks, my last three decades have spent listening to the concerns of deputies, developing great relationships with the citizens, and addressing livability issues from the street level.
Sure.
I started to become greatly concerned. The deputies and citizens coming to me saying, asking, what's next? And my compassion towards my deputies and the citizens is abounding. And I quite frankly, retiring, my pension is fine.
Mm-hmm.
I own a couple of businesses that I run myself. I've pretty successful self-defense schools over the last 15 years that have been quite successful. I'm got a lot of duties I need to attend to with family businesses, and I'm at a point where I cannot leave these deputies and the citizens where things stand. I'm compelled to run because I want things to work out. I want to make sure that the ship is steered in the right way. Mm-hmm. And I want to bring the great, like I've written on my website, we need the shine to stay on this gem of a county we have. It's a beautiful place.
So what kind of concerns have you been hearing from folks? Can you tell us just a little more specifically?
There is a definite detachment of communication between us line level employees and upper management.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if this great gem we have, especially as a sheriff's office, some of our real positives are the relationships we have with the community and our love for the community and the great deputies we have. I mean, we have great men and women working the ranks, and they feel a little I won't even say misdirected, I would say non-directed at this
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
And so being an MBA and a pragmatic engineer and a great police officer, that affects me deeply.
Yeah.
I'm such an honest, pragmatic person. I can't honestly leave here without some accountability to the taxpayers, whether it be with our staffing, whether it be with our fiscal responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Being an MBA, in the line level supervisor ranks, I analyze every decision that's made, right? And I've seen decisions made that there's a lack of sincere cost analysis, sincere taking. a collaborative stakeholder theory of citizens, of deputies, the people that really make a difference, into account.
Mm-hmm.
And that ends up being, in the end, it ends up really wearing on you, because a true decision has to, you know, big decision. I mean, we're talking decisions that would be million-dollar decisions.
Yeah.
We have to have a cost analysis.
Right.
We have to know, we have to have our experts involved with the fact-finding. And it's always, it's difficult to see this happening right before my eyes and take an honest step away from this, from my position, and continue to watch the county grow. I mean, we're heading in some times with all the recent news and whatnot.
Yeah.
You know, with up in this county, there's some black eyes on law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want people to know is that the average cop out there on the street, 99.99999% of us, we don't like people to tarnish our badge. Those of us that got into it as a quote calling,
mm-hmm.
we don't like people embarrassing us. And we're in a community now that loves the sheriff's office, and
right.
I don't want that falter. Right.
Right?
It's already just with, you know, 24-hour news and all that, you know, and the speed of information.
Yeah,
we already get an instant impact from that.
Right.
Right. And so, it's going to be a real difficult court with recent news. Keeping deputies motivated, keep the citizens understanding the sincerity and the mission of the sheriff's office.
Yeah.
Well, we really appreciate your passion for this and your long experience, Lynn. Thank you so much for your desire to run. I mean, I know it's a lot of work, and like you mentioned, you're looking to hit the ground running. So we're just appreciative that it sounds like there will be several really experienced candidates with a long history, not just in law enforcement, but with this particular community and this particular department. We're really grateful. That shows that you care. You know, that
yes.
that long relationship that you have. So thank you again, and I'm sure we'll talk to you later on the campaign trail.
Yeah, I thank you, Tyler.
All right, take care.
After nearly 12 years at its original location on North 1st Street in downtown Canby, the Canby Music Store is about to have a new home. And we mean that in every sense of the word. Their new location is a commercial property on the corner of Douglas and 1st, next to Neurotherapeutic Pediatric Therapies, which is, in fact, a historic home. And despite its commercial zoning, it's pretty much just been a home ever since it was built in 1923, by a man named Chris Harris. Next to us is what's now Neurotherapeutic Pediatric Therapies, but everybody still kind of knows it as a restaurant. It was Jarbo's, Grand Central, the Elm Street Inn, said Canby Music owner Brian Haynes, standing inside the nearly 100-year-old structure last week. I actually found about 100 old menus from the Elm Street Inn upstairs. The two properties have been owned together for a long time, and I think it used to be that whoever was running the restaurant was actually living in the house. For Haynes, the move is exciting and terrifying. Transforming a residential property into a commercial one is no small feat, especially when the structure was built almost a century ago. Haynes and his team have stripped the building's insides down to the original hand-hewn 2x4s. The interior will be completely renovated, rewired, and refinished. Despite the challenges of the renovation, it's easy to see why he chose this place over the other commercial properties in Canby. Well, there are other places we could have looked at, like around Waite Park, but I wanted to be on 1st Avenue facing 99E like I always have been, he said. This place is zoned commercial. It's big, it's got a lot of property, it's nice, and it's going to take a lot of work to get us there. His reasons for moving are just as obvious and can be summed up in a single word: space. In his current digs, Haynes' tiny office doubles as a lesson room, storage room, break room, cafeteria, and on several occasions, a podcast recording studio. The new store will have four dedicated lesson rooms downstairs. The main floor will all be retail, while the top floor, for employees only, will be the office, storage area, and repair workshop. In other words, the space will still be multi-purpose, but hey, at least it's three times as big. Outside, Haynes has already repainted the place to be on-brand Canby Music Blue, and he has a sign going up this week. The side porch is wired for concerts, and he's going to build a surrounding patio using reclaimed bricks from the former house's former fireplace and chimney. He will also be cleaning up the grounds and adding a parking area. Once the sign is up, Haynes expects to be inundated with requests from curious residents who were already wondering what was going on with that big blue house on the corner. "There are good things happening here at 590 Northwest First," Haynes said. "Everybody likes to watch the progress." That includes Canby native William Kaiser. For him, that big blue house is his childhood home, and he said he's glad to see it being restored and repurposed. "I've been watching the process and just loving all of the improvements," he said. "The house has good bones, and I'm glad they're going to be using it." In one of those twists that makes the old-timers shake their head and say, "That's Canby," Kaiser and Haynes' father, Norman, are old friends and former high school classmates. Not only that, they were born in the same hospital on the exact same day. Kaiser has a lot of fond memories of growing up in what his folks always called the old Harris place. He loved to explore the area beyond the Canby post office, which is now a residential subdivision, but it was a working sawmill, its grounds littered with bark and wood chips. "When I was a child, like 5 or 6, I would go down there and catch lizards that lived underneath the bark," he recalled. "Then I would take a shovel in my wagon and dig up trees and bring them back home and plant them in the yard." His parents never knew what he was up to, but you could ask Haynes about them. He was the one who had to remove those same trees decades later and have them carted out on a logging truck. Kaiser, who owns Marywood Farm on South Casto Road east of town, thought it was funny that he would wind up in the Christmas tree business, where he sometimes plants 150 trees a day. "I guess I'm still doing the same old stuff," he said, chuckling. Dusty menus and long defunct restaurants were not all Haynes found when he bought the place. There was also this old cabinet that looked like it might be an antique. Norman Haynes reached out to Kaiser, who confirmed that it had belonged to his family and that he'd love to have it back, but he was too busy with Christmas tree customers to come get it. So the Haynes's loaded it up and delivered it themselves, because that's Canby. Quote, "Bill told me later that he used to play in it when he was a kid," Brian said to the cabinet. "He even drew a steering wheel inside and pretended to drive around in it. He uses it to store his homemade wine now." Well, I guess no one ever told him not to drink and drive. Haynes said he does not have a definitive timeline for the move and grand opening, but he's aiming for this summer. "We don't have a time frame," he said. "It's still going to be some months, but I'm hoping to get in here in the summertime. We'll see how it goes." After a moment, he added with a laugh, "Oh, and we're going to do a lot of big sales before we move, because I don't want to move all that stuff."
Hey, Tyler. So it's February, and you know what that means. You know, there's a certain feeling in the air.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Tax time.
What? Valentine's?
No, I was saying tax day is coming up for when you file.
Oh, but it's also Valentine's. You know.
Oh man. You know, I might need to call my wife real quick. I might be in trouble.
Okay. Well, if you're looking for some place to have a fun date night, you can always try the Wild Hair Saloon, where Canby goes to eat and have fun. They've been in business for over 16 years, serve a fresh, locally sourced menu, and donate over $20,000 to Canby Sports and other causes each year. Check them out just off of Highway 99E next to Space Age in Canby at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City, or just go to their website, thewildhairsaloon.net.
Hey, honey, so good news, bad news. Good news, we got our taxes filed early this year.
The Can Be Now podcast is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Can Be by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. Find more of her work at olivia13.com.
The Can Be Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The Can Be Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.